And like any new technology, they take a little while before they perfect it. And of course, let's face it, they were usually designed by people who weren't typists, weren't they?
Yep. Now, when I asked earlier about how your own outlook and political views were influenced by working for Mr. Fraser, you spoke of Petro Georgiou.
Yes, I got waylaid. I think I've found a soulmate in Petro, in the sense of having a similar background but right of centre views, although I think Petro and I would consider our views fairly centre of the road. And the freedom of association and the freedom of the market perhaps would take us towards the right of centre, and not, big brother type control. That's the very general sense of why I would be slightly right of centre in political views. And certainly that was reinforced by the political views that were espoused in the letters that I was typing, in the speeches that I was typing. I did one time, when Mr. Hayden was opposition leader and they were looking for tactics and something to throw at Mr. Hayden, I remember coming up with some suggestions, and Petro very generously saying, "That's a great idea," and writing it into the speech. So I think I might have had an inkling then that political advice was the way I might end up decades later.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What was it, a political office? Like, were other workers there interested in politics?
You don't work in a political office if you're not interested in politics, particularly if you're an advisor. Although some people do it just, to get it on the CV, but generally you really do need an interest and a definite understanding of politics. At the junior level, if you don't have an understanding, you need to get one very fast.
And in the interview for the position, was there any interest in whether you were sympathetic to the person you would be working for? Or
no, I suspect that the view was, well, the secretaries didn't need to have any knowledge or interest because we weren't there to think. It was a long time ago.
Yes. Now, regarding thinking, I mean, did an interest in politics develop to the extent where you would start to read political books or philosophical books?
It gradually started, yeah. Mm-hmm. It gradually started. In fact, one of the selling points at the interview, when I was learning shorthand, the dictation was taken from pages of Hansard, and I can remember that the dictation passage would be a specific time, for obvious reasons, sort of marked out dictation time. And so a lot of the shorthand short forms related to political terms. And I remember, even as a 16-year-old learning shorthand, being frustrated that the Hansard passage had finished while I was still interested in it. So there probably would have been an interest in politics way back if that interest had been sparked. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing to spark the interest when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Not even things like the Vietnam War or the women's liberation.
Oh, I read the female eunuch, and that really opened my eyes. But it still seemed detached. It seemed a long way from where I was. The Vietnam War, I was young enough to be going out with a fellow who might have been called up, and we talked about that. But again, because it didn't touch me or my family immediately, it was just news on TV. So I didn't develop, and I wasn't involved with people who had strong views, so there weren't those kinds of debates to generate a strong interest. That would probably, it would have been completely different with mixing with different people.
Mm. But reading,
it's hard to imagine, isn't it, that somebody who's interested in current affairs didn't actually develop that interest until the 20s.
That's what happened. But it's interesting that you read The Female Eunuch.
I'm not quite sure why. It was quite a revelation, and it really, you know, did open my eyes to, life. Mm.
And did you think that the Fraser as Prime Minister had an attitude to the women's issues that tallied with your own?
Didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
I was there to work. He was, from my perspective, he was a good person to work for. I was terrified of him because he's this giant of a man who was known to be very gruff, and if you didn't produce what he wanted, when he wanted it, he wasn't very happy. Luckily, my shorthand was good, so if ever I took dictation from him, I was always fine with getting him back what he'd asked for. And we all used to... He used to go to Nareen for weekends, his family farm, and he would take one of the secretaries with him each weekend. He didn't take the policy or advisors or the speechwriters. And the farm was set up in such a way that the manager's cottage was changed to an office. The living area was an office, and the kitchen was a functioning kitchen, although they soon realised not to suggest that I do any cooking. And we were down there with the security guards, the two security guards, and they would sleep in the cottage, and the secretary would sleep in a spare bedroom up at the homestead with the Fraser family.
And did you do that?
Yes. Yeah. They were very sweet, very lovely. So I saw his gruff side, but I also saw the very friendly family side. But of course, we were staff. We weren't part of the family, so we were never treated as such. But I have a lovely memory. I used to go down for New Year's Eve and do a changeover with one of the girls. I'm not quite sure why. She always worked on Christmas Day and over the Christmas period at Nareen. And because my parents were in Melbourne, I would get a Commonwealth car back to Melbourne Christmas Eve, so I'd be at home for Christmas Day. And I was really nervous. I was all packed to go one day, and it must have been fairly late. We must have been busy. And though it was cool, I remember it was cool, and I went to knock on their door to say Merry Christmas and leave. And I only did that because I was incredibly shy, which most of my friends find difficult to believe now, but I was very shy. But I knew it would be even worse if I left without saying goodbye. I knew it was polite to say goodbye. So I knocked on the door to say goodbye, and they were in the living room, and there was Mr. and Mrs. Fraser, Mrs. Fraser Senior, Mr. Fraser's mother, and one of the children, I think. Must have been, I'm pretty sure the kids were old enough then. Sitting around a card table in front of the fire playing cards, very sweetly saying Merry Christmas when I took off. It was very nice.
Are there any other anecdotes about actually staying there?
I remember, you have to remember there were no mobile phones, no computers, and people were generally out of touch when business closed. However, everyone in our office provided contact numbers for weekends, and ministers were supposed to do the same. And there was a particular time, I don't remember the issue, but the Prime Minister wanted to speak to Walt Fyfe, his minister, who had gone to an island somewhere with no phone. And I was more afraid to come back and say, no, I can't find him, than I was to keep trying to find him. I found out, in fact, maybe it was holidays and not a weekend, but I know there was no business at the time. I remember finding out that there was a mail plane that would fly to that island on that day or the following day, and that plane carrying mail had a radio phone on it. I found a way of getting the Minister Fife to the plane on the radio phone on the plane, because I did not want to go back to the Prime Minister and say I couldn't find his minister. Mm-hmm. So now people who the young people who work for me learn very quickly, if I say, have you found so-and-so? And if they say, I've left a message, they know that's not the answer. How hard have you tried to find that person? And that was, I guess, that kind of determination was useful in journalism as well, where you just keep going until you find the person. Yeah, yeah. So I can remember Mrs. Fraser teaching the elder daughter to drive and having to run out of the way as they came down the dirt road between the house and the cottage, the manager's cottage where our office was. But they're always very, very friendly.
Can I ask a bit more about the office? How would you describe the working conditions?
Very crowded. Old Parliament House was well past its use-by date by then, and that was 78, and they didn't move for another 10 years. As I said, one of the offices was a converted couch, and it was very, very active and very, and I think you'd say noisy, because the typewriters were noisy, there was something happening, there were politicians coming in all the time trying to break their way in to see the Prime Minister, but usually they'd end up seeing one of the advisors or speechwriters along the way. So it was just always, always something happening. The positive side of that, and I can understand why people like open plan offices, you didn't have to ask what was going on. You'd pick it up because you'd hear all the discussions and certainly in the general office, not in the speechwriter's offices.
How were the relationships among the staff?
Oh, like anywhere where there's a lot of pressure and stress, they could be a little snappy at times, but it was actually quite a good, well-functioning office when I was there, in the sense that if something wasn't quite right, people would say so, and then they'd get on with business. Now, there's the usual gripes about this one and that one, but there was nothing ever terribly serious.
What about the trade union? Were you in a union?
No. The only time I ever joined a union was when I was working at the Canberra Times, and the union rep stood over the desk and folded his arms and told me I'd better do it or else.
And again, talking about routines, where did you eat? Did you have morning tea, afternoon tea?
Oh, there's no time for that. We used to, we had a little toaster machine in the office so that when Cabinet finished, we'd actually get stuck into the leftover sandwiches from Cabinet and toast them. Yeah, yeah. So there was a bit of snacking going on, but I never really learnt to cook, so yeah, I've just mainly snacked.
Would you eat in the dining room at all?
No, not that I recall. There was a canteen. I only recall using that when I was working back there as a media a journalist. I don't recall. I guess we only recall things that are sort of relevant or important to us.
Mm, yeah.
And I know I drank a lot of coffee. And yes, I certainly drank a lot of coffee. Mm.
Now, Canberra would have been, well, I know that it was a very different place back then. How did you travel to work and get home, especially if you're working late at night?
I drove. I tended to live relatively close to Parliament House. I think the farthest out I ever lived was Hughes. So I lived in Red Hill. And it just took a few minutes to drive to work. In fact, before the new building was built, and I knew that there was going to be a building on that site, it's one of those things you always say, I will do this, but you never do. On my way to work, I would see, driving along Adelaide Avenue, I'd see the the hill in front of me and think, oh, one day I'm going to bring my camera and take a picture of the hill before Parliament House is built, but I never did.
Did you have a social organisation, a staff club?
No. We saw enough of each other during the week. Occasionally, very, very occasionally, we'd go to each other's places for a meal. And some of the girls became great mates. I'm, you know, quite friendly with a lot of them, but not to the point where I'd see them all the time.
Did you have a family at all in Canberra? Did you?
No, I never got around to it. Got married briefly. Didn't like being married, so I think I'm just too disorganised, and life is just so much easier if you don't bother.
Were there any people you worked with who you came to admire greatly?
I think in my own way I admired Malcolm Fraser, perhaps because of his presence, because of his seniority. I saw a softer side to him that a lot of people didn't see. He was, as I said, he was always very kind to me. There was one time there was a crisis that had something to do with China, and one of the ministers, or was it his treasurer, and we're up all night. We didn't sleep all night. There was phone call. You know, I was getting people on the phone for him all the way through the night, and we were flying out the next day. And, of course, like, I was in my 20s. You don't need sleep in your 20s. I was fine. The adrenaline was still pumping like crazy. But he was most concerned that I was okay the next day, even though no one had slept during the night. And, you know, I suppose you'd say, well, that's normal, people should be, but he had a lot on his mind, and, yes, and I appreciated the fact that he was concerned that I was okay. Yeah, so I did see that side of him.
Were there any of the politicians that you came not to admire during that time?
For various reasons. There's a lot, yeah. I didn't see a lot of what went on behind the scenes. I recall going to... I didn't do a lot of socialising, but it must have been an after-budget party. When John Howard was treasurer, he had the world's best parties, and they would go all night.
Okay.
And really good parties, because lots of fun. And that was interesting. And I remember it. One party, very nice-looking young National Party politician, was being cornered by a girl who was trying to persuade him to leave the party with her, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. I think I must have had a fairly sheltered life, because it was the first time I'd ever seen somebody being compromised. And I actually think he was single at the time. He would have only been late 20s or early 30s. Yeah. He probably doesn't even remember it.
Are there political events in those 2.5 years here that stand out in your mind?
None actually came to mind when I was thinking about this, because I was on the periphery. So, and I know if I saw those events, it would trigger my memory, but they don't come to mind. They didn't resonate, because I gradually got interested in current affairs rather than actually watching current affairs at the time. My very first overseas trip was with Malcolm Fraser, and that was to India. And that was... I think I've travelled nearly every year since then, because... it was just so fascinating. And I remember at the time when the secretaries were asked to decide who wanted to go on the Europe trip or the India trip, and I know one of the other women wanted to do the Europe trip, and I remember thinking, oh, I'll go to Europe when I'm older, but I'd probably never go to India. And now I know that the more out of the way, unusual culture, the more likely I am to want to go there. So I'm really grateful for that opportunity.
I want to ask more about Malcolm Fraser a bit later, if that's okay, because just a a few more questions about the kind of routine nature of the work you mm-hmm. were doing. Was there a security clearance involved?
No, there wasn't. That came in. Any kind of a security issue came in a long time after I was there. Actually, my very first trip, talking about security, my very first trip interstate was to Sydney. And I happened to be up working at, must be midnight, well, 1 o'clock or somewhere around then, at the Hilton Hotel when it was bombed. That was my very first work trip. Well, the first one I remember anyway. And I remember looking, we're right up on a very high floor, and I can remember looking down at the carnage.
So you actually...
I was there. What was really scary was I'd actually gone out, as I was saying, when you're young, you don't need sleep. I'd actually gone out the night before, and at that time I had been walking through those doors. The night before. So I only thought about that, you know, a week or so after the incident. I realised that I was incredibly lucky.
So did you hear the explosion?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. We were, as I said, we were right up. Whoever it was that was writing the speech and I were up. And we thought, because the sound came up through the lift well, our immediate thought was a lift had collapsed or a lift had fallen, because we heard it from inside, the noise from inside the building rather than outside. And it was, you know, when you heard the sort of heard sirens and lights and everything, we kept working.
That was my next question. How did you react?
Well, you don't realize, you see people and action all those floors below without actually seeing exactly what it was. And you had a job to do. The Prime Minister was giving a speech the next day. It was Chogham. He was giving a speech the next day. It was at Chogram. It was the regional meeting. And we had a job to do.
And then the next day you discovered what had happened.
The news started to filter up during the evening what had happened, and I rang my parents straight away, woke them up, just said, you're going to hear something on the news, but I'm okay. I suspect they wouldn't have even thought that I was going to be there, but I think it was a reassurance by the state, by the time that we'd found out what had happened, just looking for, you know, the security, the reassurance, and talking to somebody. I think that's why I called. It never occurred to me to seek that with colleagues.
Did you at any point see Mr. Fraser's reaction?
No. No, I don't remember anything about that.
I asked about security clearances, but I'm wondering if you've ever been asked to keep secrets. As part of the job, being warned about journalists wanting information or
that's what I've done in jobs since then, since I've been a journalist and know what journalists get up to. I think I was a little afraid of journalists, yes, when I used to go up to the press gallery or through the press gallery to the press office. I would walk without looking sideways at the journalists or the journalists' offices. They were sort of like another species as far as I was concerned. But I don't know that journalists even bothered speaking with us. Although I do know one of the girls ended up marrying one of the journos. I didn't even talk to them, so, yeah.
Can we talk a bit more about Malcolm Fraser?
Yes, please.
Okay. As I said, we're very interested in the Prime Ministers here, having the... Australian Prime Minister's Centre as part of our role and responsibility. I'm wondering, you've mentioned that you saw a softer side to him than the media really portrayed. But can you provide any other examples of that?
It's hard to find specific examples. I've got a notoriously bad memory to start with, so I come away with impressions. One of the things that I do remember now that really struck me and showed me politics in action, and again, I can't remember the issue, but I do remember that Fraser was under siege. I think, was it when Mr. Lynch was in hospital? I think I was working for him then. But it was an incredibly difficult time. He'd not been in Canberra, so he must have either been travelling or in the electorate. And I was waiting with trepidation because I was thinking he's going to be miserable when he comes in, or he's going to be stressed when he comes in, because of it was one of those times of incredible political pressure. And he bounded into the office and was very positive, G'd up, firing, ready to go. And I've learnt since then that one of his sayings, and I didn't hear it at the time, but I've learnt that he used to say, the best form of defence is attack. And so he was under siege. Rather than crawling into a hole, he was his persona through the office and with his colleagues was, you know, he was fighting on. And that was one of those, we have little wake-up points along the way when we learn about different things, and that was one of my revelations with regard to politics and how it works.
I should have asked earlier, how well did you get to know him?
Not as well as a lot of the others in the office. As I said, I was incredibly shy. He wouldn't even remember I was there. I was so quiet. So, and he, you know, he was in office for quite some time and had a lot of people go through the office. So he would vaguely remember my being down at Nareen from time to time, vaguely remember my taking shorthand if his favourite secretary wasn't available at the time, who was Kathy Queeley. But I didn't really spend any, you know, you wouldn't call it like quality time. I did personally occasionally feel under siege in the office because I was, you know, right just out of home and never been away from home, and Petra used to call me into his office from time to time and shut the door, and there's smoke everywhere because there were smoking offices then, and he'd give me a smoke and say, you know, have a smoke, love, how is it in the snake pit?
Yeah.
So he was very sympathetic. He knew I was a bit of a softie. And but I, you know, I have to say I have that recollection, but I don't have any recollection of bad times in the office as well. I've only remembered the good times. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the nice things about Petro. Malcolm Fraser wouldn't have noticed that. He was too busy getting on with the job.
But would you see him pretty much every day when you're working?
When Parliament was sitting, and every day, but not necessarily doing something with him every day. He'd come out to the office and say, "Where's Kathy?" or "Where's so and so?" and or looking for one of the advisers who wasn't in his office. "Where's so and so?" So we would always know where they were going and be able to find them. If you're travelling with him, pretty much the same thing, because you're filtered by the advisors. They had the speechwriters, they had a closer relationship with him than we did. Although when we'd set up our office, as I said, when we travelled, we'd set up the office in motel or hotel room. He would come through looking for things or checking things. But it was very much, I don't remember anything other than a working environment. Okay. I remember taking him out. I remember we took him out for his birthday to the restaurant at the Cotter Dam, which is very sad because it was destroyed in the fires in 03. But I remember that. And somebody had a car accident in the car park with a police car, I think. Anyway.
And how did he respond to that? How was that organised?
I didn't do it. I think his diary secretaries organised that. And I just remember being there. I can remember going to those types of social functions, and especially I remember the first one. I actually used to physically pinch myself I couldn't believe I was there.
And how would you address him?
Mr. Fraser. Yeah, the advisors called him PM.
And how would he address you?
Hey. What do you want? What are you doing? Can you do this for me now?
Okay.
He always said it politely.
What do you think of his effectiveness as a politician? I suppose this is something I'm asking you, not just as somebody who worked for him, but when you look back on him in that period of prime ministership.
I have to let other people judge that because I hear a lot of criticism of him not using his majority in the Senate when he had it. I hear the frustrations of him not adhering to his treasurer's advice, who was Howard at the time, and I understand that they didn't get along well. I never saw that. So I like my impression of him as a dedicated politician who was there for all the right reasons. Now, that's probably a little rose-coloured, but that's the way my life was then. So as for an academic analysis, a critical analysis, I couldn't honestly provide it. You know, I can talk the way any journalist and former journalist can and pontificate, but okay. I don't like to
fair
do that.
Enough, fair enough. No, that's fine. How many times did you travel with him?
Oh, I've lost count. It would have been every 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And mostly within Australia, I take it?
Mostly within Australia, yeah. Yeah. I think I only had the one overseas trip, or maybe I got New Zealand as well. Oh, yeah, I think I got New Zealand as well, because that became a joke in my life. All my trips ended up being New Zealand for a while. Mm.
And on those trips, again, was it a situation where the advisors and speechwriters were like a buffer?
When you're travelling overseas, you do the same as here. Set up an office as best you can, make things work as best you can. It was a challenge to do that in India. I suspect India's a little like that now, that things usually don't work. You've got to try a few times to get phone lines at work and that sort of thing. Making phone calls in India, you had to ring up a switchboard operator and say the number. You couldn't actually dial through from wherever we were. I can't remember.
And when you left in June 1980, was it?
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of you leaving?
I'd had a fight with Alan Jones.
Oh. You've got to please elaborate.
I wasn't going to go into that, but he wasn't a terribly pleasant person to work with in the office. He came to the office during the time I was there. When we travelled, I used to always go down on a week. If we were going to be in Melbourne on a Monday, I would go down on a weekend and spend the time with my parents. After 2.5 years and working from 8:30 in the morning until midnight or 2 a.m., 5 days a week, and often on weekends, I was really tired. I was getting to the point of being a little bit bored and thinking, well, I'll stay to the end of the year and save some money. And there was this particular time where Mr. Fraser was going to be in the Melbourne office on a Monday, and I was the duty person for that Monday. The others who didn't, whoever else was travelling, hadn't lived in Melbourne, so was going down on the Monday or whatever, I can't remember. Alan Jones called me on the Saturday to ask me to come to the office, and I said, well, sorry, I'm in Canberra, I'm not in Melbourne. And he screamed and yelled at me and told me I was lazy and hopeless and useless, which if you're not tired and exhausted, you could just not worry about. And these days I just laugh. But I was particularly hurt by being told I was lazy, knowing that I wasn't. And I rang up whoever. There was an acting principal private secretary at the time, Ian McKay. Haven't thought about him for years. And I rang up and left a message on his home phone and said, "This is Cheryl and I quit," and hung up. So I stayed for two more weeks and then took 6 months off, went back to school, and in that 6 months I worked as a jewelleroo.
Gee, fascinating life you've had. Gee. And now that Alan Jones, what was his position in...
He was a speechwriter, advisor.
And he is the famous Alan Jones.
Yes, he's that Alan Jones. Alan Jones, who I bumped into many years later, I was working as a radio journalist. He was at the same function, I think he was the footy coach at the time or something. And I said, "Oh, hi, Alan, do you remember me?" He said he did. And I said, "Oh, it's amazing where some of us end up, isn't it? It's amazing where we end up, isn't it?" And he quietly looked me up and down. He said, "Well, it's amazing where some of us end up."
What? Dear me.
I haven't seen him since.
Can we finish today's session? I've just got a few more questions.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Getting back to the building here.
Mm-hmm.
What are your fondest memories of your time here?
Well, fondest memories.